Alright, you're on with SIW Radio from SecurityInfoWatch.com, and this week's episode we have some of the speakers from a webinar that we did on February 5th with the teams from Cisco, Intrametrics Consulting, Consilient Technologies, and Readiness Resource Group. And today with us we have Steve Collin, Director of Cisco's Physical Security Solutions. We also have Keith White, who's the CEO of Intrametrics Consulting, and Kevin Daly, VP of IP Physical Security, Consilient Technologies. Keith and Kevin worked very closely on an Amtrak facility deployment that was mentioned during that webinar. We also have Paul Thatcher, Business Development Manager for Cisco's Physical Security Group, and probably just ringing in, Chris?
That's Lindsay.
Oh, that's Lindsay. So we've also got Lindsay Hebert from Cisco's Physical Security Solutions Group. What we're going to do for today's podcast is we're going to run through some of the questions and that we got and didn't have time to hit on during the webinar. And one of the first ones that came in, when David Shepard, CEO of Readiness Resource Group, was speaking, and of course David is not able to make it with us today, but they asked, he mentioned non-nuclear EMP as a new threat, and what EMP is a electromagnetic pulse technology that's been around, been in, under investigation, he told me, since World War II. I know the U.S. Army has done some reports on this, and this is basically an electrical bomb, if you will, that can be built into a briefcase or into into a larger version that might be vehicle-mounted. Briefcase, of course, needs to be within a few feet of any sort of electrical machine that it's targeting. The vehicle-mounted ones can operate within, as long as they're within several hundred yards, they can sometimes be effective. So the EMP, the best place if you, to look for this in the pop media, if you've seen Ocean's 11, and you remember the guy drives the van with the big electrical bomb in the back and shuts down the casino's power. That's EMP as portrayed in a fictional life. So that runs through his first question. One of the other questions we got today on that day was about funding, and everyone wanted to know more and more about funding. Obviously, huge topic as budgets are strapped here in 2009. Speaking with Dave again and a lot of folks on the call, grants.gov was a highly suggested place for people to go to get more information about federal grants for security applications. Does anyone else on the line have any other suggestions for places to go for funding and grant sources for physical security?
Well, of course, we'd like to announce the Cisco Capital offerings that we have out there. These are both towards the end user themselves as well as to our partners to help secure funding in these tight economic times. You can reach that through cisco.com / go/ Cisco Capital, and that'll get you to a couple pages that will lead you to both end-user capital financing and our partner capital financing. And then the other thing that Cisco has available is what we call our grant office program. And what this is in conjunction with another external firm that keeps track of the various grants that are out there and can help guide your customers through the grant application and applying process to actually go after these grants that are available through various state, local agencies.
Okay. Yeah, and Paul's offered some great tips there that you should check out as well. One of the other things that David did mention to me when he said that he would not be able to be on this recording, knew that this question would come up. He said, look for nonprofit foundations. He said, surprisingly, these may have some small grants and funding sources that you can maybe even just hire one person to part-time or full-time to resource these kind of grant sources that may be coming from the nonprofit community as well. Well, let's hit on a couple more other questions. So one of the questions we wanted to hit on today, and it really feeds back into the webinar since that was talking a lot about moving from analog to IP connected systems. A question came in mainly targeted towards Steve Collin of, do you see the need for new operator training when moving from the analog to the IP systems? And the question continued and said, old-fashioned analog operators and managers tend to stick with what they know, and does this become a barrier to business, and how do we meet this challenge of new training for the operators? Steve, any thoughts?
Yeah, a couple of things that I would probably comment on with regard to that question. So firstly, it's possible to actually continue to use the existing operator interfaces in certain cases. So with, for example, the use of encoders and decoders, you can keep much of the edge equipment that you use today in place, and that can be a critical consideration. So in that respect, your guard or your operator might not even need to be retrained on a new interface, while at the same time, they can still connect into the IP network and take advantages of that. The second thing that I would comment on is that it's really important for IP-based systems to have user interfaces that are simple and intuitive. And when you're selecting a vendor, whoever it might be, make sure that that's one of the areas that you look at. Certainly, it's an area that we prioritize in Cisco, but so do many other vendors. So check that out as you're considering which system you buy.
Good point there. I'm going to point the next question to Keith and Kevin. These guys, of course, did the Amtrak project, and that was at least 10 separate sensor groups, you know, everything from or sensor groups and systems such as video analytics, you know, high-resolution video, IP intercom, access control. They connected a lot of different systems. The question came in, you know, if all my systems are separate and I lose one during an incident or during normal operations, I'm only losing that one. But if I go to a networked integrated system, what keeps me from losing it all at once? Keith and Kevin, you guys have any thoughts on that?
I could comment on that. This is Kevin with Consilient Technologies, and I would suggest that the person who is who posed the question think in terms of the fact that they will have all their data captured on a remote situation. The video systems will continue to record, access control will continue to log activity, but they will only get real, they will lose real-time access to that as all the data is dispersed rather than the data being fed into a central location. We may not have been clear enough on the call to indicate that the data lives at, be it one site or 100 sites locally, in exact access remote for analysis. All the data is not fed into a central location. So if you lose your network connectivity at one site, you lose access to just that one site during a real-time event.
Okay. And that's a great point as well, is that, you know, the network is just really the remote access that's bringing all the separate ones together. So it's you've not lost the backbone of the individual systems. Steve, do you have any thoughts on that as well about, you know, worries about network systems and networks going down?
No.
He's got no worries at all.
No, I mean, one of the advantages of an IP network is essentially that you can route around failure, as we say. So you can have parallel paths between locations that you can use should problems occur. Also, the fact, you know, that as we just heard, you can place locations in primary, you can place systems in primary and secondary locations and use the network to fail over from one to the other. In Cisco, for example, we have four security operations centers that are dotted around the globe. If one of those fails, the next can come online within 30 seconds, literally, and pick up the workload. And that's something that a traditional hardwired physical security system simply cannot do. We have lots of parallels and experiences of the IP telephony space as well with regard to this. And the telephone network based on IP cannot be allowed to fail. And so in Cisco, we spent a lot of time honing our expertise in that area.
That's a great point as well. That and you think about you lose a coaxial cable and your video goes down, and maybe something chews through it or something accidentally chops it. You're not going to be back up in 30 seconds. There's no way to quickly reroute around that, short of having a duplicate wired model there. Looking back, the Amtrak deployment, of course, grabbed a lot of our viewers' attention. And someone wanted to know how did you determine and evaluate the products used on the Amtrak deployment? Keith, is that something that you did?
Yes, we wrote the performance requirements based on the current operating procedures of Amtrak Police, and then they have a security force, contract security force, managing their site. There's only five full-time Amtrak police officers on the West Coast. And that's, obviously they're covering a great deal of real estate and track. One thing I did want to add to the question about the separate systems is that each of the disparate systems runs in the background on its own. So even when you do additional programming or adding of devices, field devices, to each of those disparate systems, they can be done as an administrative function from that individual system's server and not affect the overall management GUI. I think that's an important piece to mention. When we went through to select, we started from the outside in. We looked at the sensors. Amtrak has a national contract with an access control provider, so that was something that we didn't consider as a performance spec. That was a requirement of the contract. But all of the other systems were pretty much wide open. We did beta test some IP technologies over the course of 5 or 6 years in not only developing this but getting funding. Same with the mass notification and paging system, looking at those IP-based technologies.
Were there any, Keith, were there any ones that were, what were the areas that were most difficult to evaluate the products? Was it the analytics, perhaps?
Analytics was difficult in the sense that there were quite a few products available to choose from. Many function well in certain areas, in certain arenas, and not as well in others. We tested more than five, but we ran five analytic platforms head-to-head in a rail station environment, not a yard where they're being employed now, but at a passenger platform. And the results are what drove us to the analytics that are in both the LA project and the Oakland project that are being implemented by Consilium Technologies.
And of course, our listeners, if you want a list of those products, you can go back and review the webinar, or if you've not signed up for it before, go to securityinfowatch.com/webinars, sign up for that February 5th Cisco Systems webinar, and you'll be able to find a slide in there that talks about the where they talk about the different technologies that were used. Keith, with the Amtrak deployment, how is the video managed for investigations and used as evidence?
Well, it's tagged as an event, so anything that activity-wise that a rule in the analytics was set up for in video is tagged as a specific event. It's labeled. And so that's recorded with a time date stamp. It can be recorded with other sensor data that comes in along with it, could have multiple video streams, but that's a function of not only the Agent VI, which is the analytics platform, but also of the Proximex interface. So it's got a reporting function built into it that, in the same way that it helps
the officer deal with an event, it logs that event in the same way. It also logs the way that the officer deals with that event, and as far as time frame, the duration it takes for them to deal with each individual event.
Okay.
One of the questions also came in discusses how do you manage the integrated solution when one of the multiple vendors in the solution modifies or upgrades their software. You know, I think that probably, Steve, you might have some thoughts on this as well.
That is a really good question.
I thought it was wonderful. A huge pressing issue. We're all promoting integration, but what happens?
Well, so there's two scenarios, actually. There's the fact that a system that's part of the larger system may have its software upgraded, but then so too may the overall system software be upgraded. So you have to basically make sure that compatibility works in both directions. So I'll give you a specific example. We in Cisco probably have tested interoperability against about 500 different endpoint devices and systems. And every time we come out with a new software release, we have to make sure that our change has not impacted our ability to work with any of those 500 different endpoint systems. So it's a hard and can be quite laborious task. One of the things that can really help is a move towards standards in the industry and towards open APIs, as we call them, but essentially a move towards standard interfaces between different systems. That will minimize the need or the difficulties that you may face with those kind of upgrades. But it can be a tricky problem, and there isn't necessarily always an easy answer, I would have to say. Testing can be automated. You know, automated regression testing, as it's called, can definitely help, and so will that move to standard interfaces. But I wish it was easier than it can be sometimes.
Now, of course, there are some groups actually working to create those standards. I understand the PSIA is one group, the ONVIF is another group, and then there's the SIA. So there are some activities that'll hopefully, you know, solve these problems. Kevin, you've been doing integration work and bring these systems together. Have you ever had this kind of problem bite you?
Well, it hasn't bit us, but on this particular project, we were very sensitive toward it in the design process. And one of the things that we spoke to Amtrak about at length was the fact that you don't need to upgrade the system as soon as a piece of software is released, as sometimes the vendors drive us to do. Obviously, vendors always like to get their latest, greatest release, but they sometimes can create nuanced problems along the way. And our position is not so much just simplistically, if it's not broken, don't fix it, but evaluate the value of the changes in the software and see if it's going to impact your day-to-day operations. If not, wait a little while and let another organization be the first to try it. I know that's not what our technology partners want to hear, but our responsibility is to our customer and making sure his uptime stays at the 99.9% range starts with making sure the software is stable and highly interoperable at all times.
That's a great point there, that you don't always have to be right on the cutting edge of the technology in every case. In fact, you know, some people, of course, will do the odd-numbered versions of upgrades, you know. Well, they'll do the version 1, the version 3, and skip the ones in between, I've heard. So, let's see. Paul, a question came in, I guess probably for one of our UK listeners. Does Cisco have a grant program in the UK?
No, unfortunately, at the present time, the grant program is only in the United States. As we get more familiarity with here in the States and understand better what the grants programs are outside of that, we're looking to expand that. But for the time being, just a U.S. domestic program right now.
Gotcha. And, of course, listeners, definitely look at Paul's presentation. Came near the end of the webinar. Had some slides with some links on Cisco's grant programs there. Let's see, some other questions coming in that came in during this. And actually, this is a probably a good question as well. Someone asked, do you have any IP video specs that you use to measure the wireless performance, such as delay, jitter, and throughput? And if so, what test equipment do you use to measure these performance specs? Well, it just so happens we not only have Keith and Kevin, who work directly on this Amtrak project, but we also have, of course, Cisco, which knows a few things about wireless networking. So I'll let let anyone who's on the line jump in and talk about measuring for wireless performance and dealing with delay, jitter, and throughput.
Well, I could speak a little bit to the negotiations that went on with each of the partners, and I think more important even than specs is the commitment from each of the partners to make sure that they stand behind the operational aspects of their technology, not just in a vacuum, but in an interoperable real-world environment. And each one of the partners, be it a camera, be it video analytics, or the wireless network provider, all were held to the same standard that if any of them don't work together, the project doesn't get accepted. And it was a challenging discussion with each of them, but to get them to understand that standalone performance specs are not what the customer is purchasing. They're purchasing a jitter-free display, and the greatest test meter is their perception of the video through their own eyes. And that's the standard to which we defined and got the vendors to accept for Amtrak on this deployment.
A great point. Anyone else want to share some thoughts about IP video and dealing with delay and jitter issues and so forth?
Well, I'll throw out one point. So we have a wireless networking business unit inside Cisco, and wireless products are obviously critical to us. We do a couple of things to make sure that those kind of issues aren't a problem. Firstly, we have internal testing, obviously, as you would expect. But secondly, we actually have an interoperability program that we run that embraces multiple different vendors. And these aren't just Cisco products, but a whole slew of cameras, for example, from third-party sources. And we actually run those in our own test environment to make sure that no kind of issues are introduced there. And this is not really just a video issue. This is a networking kind of performance characterization that you're doing. So jitter and loss, may be evidenced by different applications of which a video is one, and we basically test to make sure that that doesn't become an issue.
That's a great point. Are you guys on your campus there in San Jose? Are you testing out wireless video?
Yes. So we have our own IP wireless cameras inside Cisco right now. Those are actually part of that wireless business unit testbed and program that I just mentioned, and wireless throughout the whole of Cisco's campus and distributed locations is absolutely central to what we're doing here. So yes, we absolutely do.
That's a perfect place to test it out. I mean, they've got a very big campus there, so I'm sure the hall distances and the amount of traffic probably are pretty good indicators. So,
yeah, I think we have approximately 2,000 cameras, about 800 badge readers of different flavors within the security deployment here. And as you say, the campus probably spans 30 significant buildings over probably a 3-mile diameter.
All right, let's see. One more question that we had come in. This should be a pretty quick one for Kevin. Concrete poles versus wood poles. Why'd you guys go with the concrete poles?
I think I might have not spoken clearly there. We actually use steel poles with concrete bases, and a wooden pole would have had the same type of concrete base. We believed that we were going to get some extra functionality out of the steel poles and that they have the ability to raise and lower a camera in the slot on the pole, much like a flagpole, to ease the maintenance process. And at a certain point, we found that the steel poles were surprisingly equal in price to the wooden poles. Traditionally, the wooden poles have been less expensive, but due to exceptional overseas demand on lumber, the prices came out almost the same, so we decided to go with the more stable steel poles.
Great point there. And so they are more stable, less sway and camera movement?
A little bit. depending on wind conditions and whatnot, which does play into the reliability of the video analytics that is mounted at the top of the poles. The less vibration, the better.
A good tip there. Definitely think about vibration in your poles and then you're using analytics. Well, one of the last questions I wanted to throw out to everyone before we end this podcast was they came in, someone asked, you know, working with so many bureaucracies, how did you get things done? And what problems did you encounter trying to integrate their legacy systems? I'm really more interested in the latter part of that question. Bureaucracies you have to deal with anywhere, and you figure those out as it is. But what problems did you encounter trying to integrate legacy systems?
This is Keith. The one of the nice things, about, at least about Amtrak West, and Kevin will hopefully concur, there weren't a lot of systems. There's just not a lot there. Both good and bad, but they just had not made the capital investment in video surveillance, access control. They were pretty much very key, critical area, analog and digital recording, CCTV, and not looking at it anywhere outside of the site, not using it as a management piece, only using it forensically. And then their not access control, it was pretty much BERG, intrusion detection. And that those systems were actually monitored. They alarmed locally, but they were monitored at the Amtrak Police Facility, their National Communication Center, or NCC, in Philadelphia. And so, you know, it was kind of a blank slate, which worked well both from for both parts of this question. It worked with coordinating with the bureaucracies. As long as we started early and got everybody's buy-in, which is, like you said, the same with any process or project, and the same with integration, it was just, you know, it was wide open. We were really able to spec and bring together the right pieces without having to worry about any hanging technology that we wouldn't be able to pull in.
That's a very fortunate scenario. I'm sure not one that you get all the time where you've got that green field.
I might be able to supplement that a little bit with the advantage of the command and control platform. One of the we talked quite a bit on the call about the advantages of correlating the data and bringing it all to one location. One of the things we do talk about to a lot of customers about is the ability for a command and control platform to build that bridge to your legacy systems as you move forward, but because it acts as the communication common denominator amongst all the platforms, so they all look the same to the command and control platform. A very, very important benefit to them that we do spend a lot of time talking about.
Good point there. Steve and Lindsay, do you guys have any thoughts on working with legacy systems and getting those into the IP framework?
Well, it's obviously really important to do because budgets are limited and you want to avoid retraining individuals. So basically, it's a really important factor for many customers out there. An IP, a pure IP approach is probably the most simple form of deployment that you can make, probably the easiest to manage as well. But most customers want to keep those analog cameras that they've had for years and years, and they're working pretty well, so why shouldn't they? And so I think that ROI, particularly during these economically challenging times, is a really important deployment consideration.
And it absolutely is. Well, gentlemen, thank you for coming on this podcast to do this Q&A. Of course, we had a great webinar, and again, listeners can go to securityinfowatch.com/webinars to find the link to this February 5th webinar with Cisco and Security InfoWatch about security and safety solutions for government and education. And again, big thanks to everyone who was able to come on this podcast today, Lindsay, Steve, Keith, Kevin, and Paul. You can find information, contact information for these gentlemen on the webinar itself.